Tonight's show is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon, Vendetti Optics, and you, our listeners. Gets super heated and then comes back to the surface really, really quickly and excretes from fissures in the side of the mountain to the tune of about 600,000 gallons a day. Now to me, that sounds like a late night run to Taco Bell. What is up, all of you wayward souls, and welcome back to the Wayward Stories podcast. Wayward Stories is the podcast where we tell the tales of our adventures in our wanderings and our wonderings. How's everyone doing this week? It's been a whole week here, but I am in the studio tonight with you guys again, telling stories, the thing that I enjoy doing the most. So I shall put the worries and cares of the work week aside for the next hour or so, and hopefully regale you with tales. Boy, I am full of words tonight, aren't I? Man, if I can keep it up like this, this is going to be the most flowery episode we've ever done. I've been doing a lot of research here lately, reading a lot of those early 1800s journals from some of these early explorers. That's going to actually figure in prominently tonight. And their language was very Victorian era. It was very, very flowery, and I find that I tend to mimic with my everyday language what I've been reading, which can be really, really interesting sometimes when I'm just like dealing with, say, my boss or some random person in public, and I am suddenly regaling you with tales, right? It's a whole different language format that's super fun, but it doesn't play well necessarily in modern society. So I will try to scale that back a little bit for you guys tonight. Let's do our housekeeping. Please like, please subscribe, please rate and review, and please word of mouth, share with your friends or share to Facebook groups. Y'all, word of mouth is how they really grow, truly. So if you guys would help me out there, I would super appreciate it. And on the note of housekeeping, this is our 90th episode, which is like 200 in podcast years. Like, I don't know if you guys know this, but there's something like 1.3 million new podcasts come out every single year. And like 99% of them stop after the second episode because those dudes get in there and they're like, yo, I didn't know this was actually going to be work. And I thought I was super clever when I'm talking to my buddies. And suddenly I'm on a microphone and I have stage fright. And it turns out I'm not that clever. This sucks. I don't want to do it anymore. And they quit doing it. Those are all over. I found some pretty cool subject matters that I wanted to look into searching for podcasts before, only to find they recorded for like two episodes and then disappeared from the face of the planet. So us making it over 3 years to 90 episodes, that is truly, we are elderly in podcast years, which kind of tracks with how my knees have been feeling here lately. Anyway, appreciate all of you guys that stay engaged with us and share us every single week. Okay, now, before we get into tonight's show, I want to share with you a book that I've been reading that I think many of you will enjoy. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. I just want to mention it and point you guys towards it and why it's been meaningful to me. Just last class before this one that I'm just now wrapping up this week. By the way, got my final grades today for my latest class, which was cultural anthropology and problems in the contemporary world or whatever. 1,000 of 1,000, aced it, still killing it. That's right. But my last class was U.S. environmental history, right? And one of the books that my professor recommended was called The Wilderness and the American Mind. And I just went blank on the author's name, but it is a iconic book, apparently, in the outdoor space. And you will find it if you just Google Wilderness and the American Mind. Y'all, that is a very, very challenging book and a super it's a great read. It's a great read. It kind of starts off a little bit slow, to be honest with you, but like when it picks up, it really picks up, and it is like an incredibly in-depth overview of really everything that I've been struggling with. That's one reason it's really resonating with me right now is, I mean, you guys, I give yuppies a pretty darn hard time, don't I? I really, really do. I openly admit that. Now, My definition of a yuppie is someone who's there with no interest in the wilderness and only there to basically commercialize themselves, and they leave all their trash everywhere. So I stand behind my comments. But as it turns out, I'm a little bit of a yuppie too. Like, and I start having to wrestle with this. Like, it's kind of interesting how all these things always tend to come into my life at certain times where I'm really struggling with something, and then I happen to find a very challenging answer to it that makes me really search my own soul a little bit, figure out what my stance really is. And on the other side, it's usually pretty cool because I have an idea of what it is I really think about the subject. But this is kind of the point of that book, is it's going over what was here when Europeans first started colonizing North America, what we took, what we extracted, what we destroyed, what is irreplaceable, what we saved, how we saved it, why we saved it. And it basically traverses the entire gamut from beginning to the modern day. And it is a fascinating work. But one of the big arguments in there, in one of the chapters named Towards a Philosophy of Wilderness, I realized that's what I've been struggling with over the last year or so, as I found myself at that place that I talked about a few episodes ago in Same Wayward, Different Wilderness. I arrived and no one was there, and I found yuppies. He kind of addresses that. And Towards a Philosophy, this has already been hashed out by like congressmen and political pundits and everyone else back in the 1940s, 50s, 60s. And in that chapter, it really pushes the limits and makes you think about, well, what is a yuppie? Who is a true wilderness person? Is it like a French fur trapper of the early 1800s? Is it, I don't know, we think of Theodore Roosevelt, you know? People talk about him today. He was an early conservationist, but he was also a big game hunter. He points out in that book that Teddy Roosevelt, when he rolled out into the backwoods for a few months on these big game hunting expeditions, he wasn't out there roughing it. He had a 200-man army of servants who were putting up palatial tents, and this guy was basically living in the lap of luxury as he carted himself around, you know, the American Midwest or Africa or wherever he was on these crazy expeditions. There wasn't all that much danger involved in what he was doing, and there was definitely not any roughing it. I mean, that doesn't sound a lot different than a 58-foot RV, does it? So it's challenging. It's challenging. What is a yuppie? I come back to, I think it's more about the intention of what you're there for, but that's for a different episode, and that probably will be an episode pretty soon. However, book review, great book. And for any of you that love the outdoors, you will, I think, get something out of Wilderness and the American Mind. Look it up, buy a copy. You can listen to it on Audible and check it out. That is not a paid advertisement. I'm just really digging on that book right now. Anyway, moving on into tonight's show, which sort of plays, this all kind of ties together because we're going to talk about Hot Springs National Park, a national park, the only national park in Arkansas per se. We have several national historic sites and a national scenic river, the first one, as a matter of fact, but we only have one national park, and that is Hot Springs. And that actually is why it kind of ties to the book I just mentioned and some of these other things, is because it was technically America's first national park. You're like, wait, but what about Yellowstone? We'll get there, my friends. We will get there. Stay on board. So I've never been there. In my entire life, I'm 43. I will be 44 in November. I grew up in this area from day one. I've been in Arkansas specifically for 20 years this year. Never been to Hot Springs, and to be honest with you, really had no effing clue what it actually was, okay? And I figured this out because when I do my time down at the National Historic Site and I volunteer down there and I work the desk specifically, I get a lot of people that come in and they're just passing through and they check out our site, but then they're like, well, what about Hot Springs? What can I expect down there? When does it close? When does it open? What's going on down there? I was literally kind of at a loss. I was like, you know, I don't know. It's a national park. You can get a stamp probably in, you know, basic business hours, 9 to 5. Other than that, I had no idea. And it occurred to me, well, I've got to go, right? I need to go experience this for myself because now I have an impetus. I have a catalyst. I have a reason to. People want to know. And I don't have an answer for them. Also, I don't have that stamp in my passport. Also, I've lived here my whole life, and that's kind of shameful. I really need to go spend the weekend down there. So that is what Jess and I did. And what I came away with was, for me and who I am, it was a very interesting place. But I discovered that in a sense, it's a little bit of a misnomer that might mislead some people. And also it's super confusing as to what the heck's actually going on down there when you get there, where to start, what to do. And the idea occurred to me, well, this is a podcast episode. It is a national park. It is a part of my personal exploration of myself and my path forward in life as I pursue a career in the National Park Service and in the line of history and cultural anthropology. And this touches on all of those things. And it's a travel place. And you can get your national park stamp in your passport. So I was like, I should really make the Idiot's Guide to Hot Springs National Park, because you kind of need an idiot's guide to it to really know where to start and what the heck to do. And that's what we're going to talk about tonight. We're going to start with Justin's history of Hot Springs National Park before we get into the official history. We're going to give you, as I love to do when we do these little travelogues and I tell you about where we're going and why we're going there, I want you to know why it's a very interesting place. I want you to know why it's even a national park to begin with, what's special about it, and that requires backstory. So Justin's 30-second history that'll take about 10 minutes, by my estimation, is that in 1803, with the Louisiana Purchase, America suddenly had a crap ton of new land to explore. Many of you have heard of Meriwether Lewis and what's-his-face Clark? He wasn't that important, apparently. I'm a historian. I don't remember. Was it William Clark? Meriwether Lewis? I know Meriwether because that's the coolest name ever. I would have named a child that had I had a boy. But everyone knows the story of Lewis and Clark, right? That was like one of the big banners of like American westward exploration, right? How many of you knew there was roughly four other expeditions that O.T. Jeff, Tommy Jeff, Tom Jefferson, sent out in the same time frame to do exactly the same thing, but explore other portions of the Louisiana Purchase, most notably the southern portions, which include Arkansas, where I'm at. And that comes into play here. We actually have the accounts. It is in a great book that I'm holding up on the screen for you here, The Forgotten Expedition, which is the Louisiana Purchase Journals of Dunbar and Hunter, and we'll talk about them a little bit more in a minute, but these two gentlemen were tapped by Thomas Jefferson to explore up the Red River. A few things happened. Their plans got a little bit redirected, and what they did is they went up the Mississippi River, the Black River, and up the Washita River in search of the Hot Springs, and they were the very first, like, European-American settlers. The French did, but they weren't there in a scientific capacity. And there were very few of them. These guys went up scientifically observing, as best as they could with the scientific instruments of the day and their knowledge, everything they saw along the way to send all of this information in a report back to Thomas Jefferson. And this was a short-lived expedition. It was wildly shorter than it was supposed to be due to circumstances. And if you buy this book, you can learn about them. But they did record the first researched and articulated history. Not history. My words fail me tonight. They put together the first scientifically articulated report of the area all the way up to the Hot Springs, because the Hot Springs were somewhat of a mythical status at that point. People knew of them. There were rumors of them, and it was like their impetus to go and find out, what are they really there? Is this really a thing? What are we going to find up there? And when we do, what can that tell us about the area? And we have their journals now, thanks to one Trey Berry, Pam Beasley, and I'm going to say Gene Clements. And they did a wonderful job. Now, for any of you who like to read historical things, like, this is fascinating stuff to me. Oh, and I mentioned there were four others. There was the Custis Freeman expedition that went up the Red River until they ran into trouble with the Spanish and got turned back unceremoniously. And then, of course, everyone has heard of Pike's Peak, right? Zebulon Pike? Well, he was another one of the expeditions. There's so much more to history than they told us in school. And let me tell you something. All of these journals, if you can get your hands on them, are absolutely fascinating. You will find One of the things they'll teach you in college is how to skim. Here's how to skim all the information that's going to be thrown at you, to skip the stuff you don't need and hone in on the stuff that you really need to focus on. I did have to do a lot of skimming. I read a couple of entries about where they're using the sextant to take the latitude, the longitude, but that's in every entry. Like, they're doing this scientifically, right? They're recording everything. I read a few of those entries just to get an idea of what they're talking, you know, what they're doing. And then I just skipped that part every time I got to a new entry because it was basically the same information over and over. And since I'm not an astronomer or a cartographer, and I don't use a sextant, though I now can, I learned how to just a couple of weeks ago. I don't really need that information, right? I was more interested in what are they seeing? What are they finding? What are they saying about the hot springs? Fascinatingly enough, they had a lot to say about the hot springs. When they arrived there, and this is between 1804, 1805, and it's around Christmas time, they actually celebrated Christmas at the hot springs. And I'm going to say that would be 1804, which was an interesting part of the story. The men had stored much spirit in preparation for this holy day, as it were. Let's just leave it at that. They had a good time that night. But that's all in these journals, and it's fascinating stuff. But they found hot springs issuing from the side of this mountain, and it was an anomaly to all of them, because I want to point out to you, at this time, we hadn't seen Yellowstone yet. No one had seen a geyser, like, not on American soil. These guys were trying to figure out a hot spring. What's going on here? They're taking temperature readings, averaging around 150 degrees. They even managed to find microscopic life, extremophiles, inside the springs, little crustaceans that were alive. It's pretty fascinating stuff. Very interesting read. The Forgotten Expedition. Look it up if you're very interested. But they found their way up, and when they got there, they found that there were some cabins and shacks already constructed around the springs. So there were early French trappers who had already found their way to the area, and they were already using these springs for whatever purposes they were using these springs for. So this was something that was in, I want to say, like, the mythology, because in a way, for a while, it was a little bit of a myth. They're like, is it really there? What are they? But it was really just floating around through the grapevine and rumors. People had heard tell there's some fascinating hot springs up here, up this Ouachita River, as it was called. And they wanted to find out what was going on. So early expeditions, super interesting stuff. Look up those journals. You can get most of them in paperback format today, which I have all in my thrift books cart. There were early other travelers and explorers like Thomas Nuttall. He made his way through Arkansas, up the Arkansas, in 1821, I believe it was. I know it's 21 for sure at one point. And he mentioned several times the Curious Springs, and he uses a lot of different names for them. There's a lot of names thrown around during that time. He never goes all the way to the springs. He stays on course mostly up the Arkansas River. That's another really cool book, and you can find it. I have it right here. Journey of Travels into Arkansas Territory during the year 1819. So there you go. Thomas Nuttall. Dude was a botanist from Boston, and he got himself in over his head, and he got waylaid by natives. He got played by river expeditioners. It's really funny. This guy was a scholarly academic guy who decided he was going on his big adventure, and then he ends up somewhere up the Canadian River, the Arkansas River, somewhere in Oklahoma, dying of dysentery for a while. And those journal entries, when he's got the yellow fever or whatever it was, if it wasn't so sad, it's kind of comical the way he writes about it. It's pretty wild. This guy is almost, he would make a great movie, to be completely honest. But anyway, the hot springs are quite famous. They have been known from very, very early times, and they became slowly America's first national park, technically, asterisk, proviso, addendum. Anyway, what are the hot springs? Well, Justin's history of the hot springs, not history, but Justin's geology of the hot springs are rainwater falls, snow melts, seeps into the mountainside, makes itself way down into the mountain, gets super heated, and then comes back to the surface really, really quickly and excretes from fissures in the side of the mountain to the tune of about 600,000 gallons a day. Now, to me, That sounds like a late night run to Taco Bell. But the National Park Service has a better explanation, and I'm going to tell that to you now. According to Hot Springs National Park's official literature, rain and melted snow trickle into cracks in brittle rock, novaculite, and chert along the ridges of the Ouachita Mountains. Gravity pulls the water slowly downward through a network of cracks in Earth's rock crust. The rock temperature increases with depth, and the water emerges from the springs at an average temperature of 143 degrees Fahrenheit. When the water reaches a major fault on the western slope of Hot Springs Mountain, pressure propels it upward. The hot spring water does not result from a volcanic process. Its round-trip journey from the recharge zone along the mountain ridges to the park takes over 4,000 years. So basically, about the time that the pharaohs were building the Great Pyramid at Giza, 4,500 years ago, the water that emerges today at Hot Springs was just falling on that mountainside. How they figure that is beyond me. I asked about it. They said it has to do with radiocarbon dating particulate in the springs currently. But I even have questions about that. Y'all, I believe in science. I really do. But, I mean, who's to say there wasn't a giant sinkhole somewhere and there's a big void down there that happened 4,000 years ago, and as the water flows back up through it, it's picking up 4,000-year-old decaying matter off of trees. Like, I don't know. Like, that just feels like a little bit of a stretch to be like, yeah, it fell 4,000 years ago because there's matter in it from 4,000 years ago. I mean, did that work all the way down 12,000 feet to wherever it heats and then all the way back up through the system with it? I don't know. That's probably good science and it probably works, but that's one of those that it's like, I feel like there's probably other things that could explain that too. Anyway, I digress. So, Hot Springs National Park today, what is it? Well, to give you an idea of how it runs out in a quick bullet point history, is 1820, the Arkansas Territory asked Congress to reserve the hot springs for public use. See, there were people there already appropriating the water for personal reasons. In 1830, Asa Thompson builds the first bathhouse near today's Fountain Street. In 1832, President Andrew Jackson signs legislation to establish Hot Springs Reservation. This here, when it becomes Hot Springs Reservation, is the moment it becomes technically America's first national park. But it is just a reservation. But it is the first public property that the federal government ever established as a reserve for the use of the public. So that in it of itself is really fascinating, because this also predates preservation and conservation movements by like some 70 years. This is really early. This is actually super progressive for the time, by a guy who hated Native Americans and did everything he could to push them off the face of the earth. But he was progressive when it came to preserving the hot springs. 1849, the Department of the Interior is established and the reservation is placed under its control. Which, interestingly enough, Department of the Interior is what is over the National Park Service still currently today. 1877, the first superintendent is named. 1883, construction begins on a stone archway. 1887, the Army and Navy General Hospital opens, which you just need to know when you go. That place is awesome. You can't go in it. You can't even get on the property. But you want to talk about the coolest looking Gothic structure from the 1880s you've ever seen that will make every urbex bone in your body ache. That Army Navy Hospital is immensely cool, and it's right down there in the middle of the national park. You're gonna like looking at that when you go. 1892, work begins on the formal entrance. 1901, to protect the thermal water and retain heat, a water collection and distribution system is installed. 1911, Department of the Interior requires wooden bathhouses must be replaced with safer, more sanitary structures. And in 1916, the National Park Service is established. The reservation is placed under its control. And in 1921, the reservation is named as a national park. And from there, lots more things happen. So, what is Hot Springs National Park today? Primarily, it preserves the early original bathhouses on Bathhouse Row. They are, in no particular order, actually they are, they're in the order that they are on Bathhouse Row, but not in chronological order, is the Superior, 1916, the smallest bathhouse on the row, and it offered affordable hydrotherapy and massages. The Hell, 1892, the oldest surviving bathhouse on the row. The Hell has a sauna in a thermal cave carved from the mountainside. The Maurice, 1912, a third-floor lounge has a stone fireplace, painted mural, stained glass skylight, and an expansive view of the row. The Fordyce, 1915, the elegant Fordyce houses the park's visitor center. Many of the rooms have been restored to their original state. The Quapaw, 1922, a tilted dome crowns a decorative scheme with an American Indian motif, scallop shells, and fished. Ozark, 1922. Sculpted mythical creatures hold urns of water. Man, I love me some sculpted mythical creatures. There's no doubt about that. And they encourage passerbys to sample the healing waters. The Buckstaff, 1912. This is the only bathhouse on the row to operate continuously for over a century. The Lamar, 1923. The Lamar offered marble bathtubs of different lengths for greater comfort. And then the administration building, built in 1936, caps off the end of Bathhouse Row. Built as the park headquarters, it was never a bathhouse, but a fountain greets visitors who entered the park from the south. Essentially, this is Hot Springs National Park. It is the Row. There's a lot more encompassed landmass-wise, but for our purposes tonight, in our Idiot's Guide to Hot Springs National Park, you're looking at it right there. And this is a great time to go to break. And when we come back, I'm going to give you the down low, the skinny, the deets, as the kids say today, about Hot Springs National Park, the best way to visit it, what you can expect to find from the visitor's point of view, and what other things in the area you can get into to fill out your day. So you guys hang around for about a minute and a half here, and we'll be right back. What is up, all of you wayward souls? I want to tell you guys about our newest sponsor, Bendetti Optics, a brand based right here in the good old US of A, Portland, Oregon, to be exact. And I bought my first pair of Bendetti sunglasses about a year and a half ago and fell in love with them so much so that I got online and ordered a couple more pair. And when I did, there was a small shipping snafu, an order fulfillment snafu, and I got on the phone, gave them a call, and guess what? I get a call back from who? One of the big men themselves, right there in Portland, from the top of the chain. Have a great conversation, and we end up starting this great relationship we have. They more than made right the little snafu that occurred, and I am now a huge proponent of them because I can tell you from personal experience, they are good people, and they are trying to compete with the big boys out there coming in at a price point of about $40, but using the exact same frame material, TR90, and the same polarization process as the big guys. As it turns out, something I think we are already probably knew in our hearts, when you buy big name sunglasses, you're buying a big name, not necessarily any more quality than you can get somewhere else, like at Bendetti Optics. They have 29 different styles. They have multiple polarization options for whatever climate you happen to live in. And they back it up with like this lifetime guarantee that if your dog eats your sunglasses, it doesn't matter how you break them, send it back in with a check to cover shipping and handling and you're golden. You got a new pair on the way. These guys are truly trying to do it right. And they have this philosophy that a really good pair of sunglasses should not cost you so much that you are afraid to wear them. And I think all of us outdoorsmen can relate to that. So if you guys, like me, are very practical and like to get more bang for your buck and wear some great looking sunglasses, check out BendettiOptics.com. That's BendettiOptics, optics.com. Or you can go over to Instagram/BendettiOptics. And that I highly suggest, whether you buy a pair or not, just to check out the cutest pupper you will ever see modeling sunglasses. Once again, that's BendettiOptics.com. And make sure and let them know Wayward Stories sent you. And welcome back. Thank you guys for sticking around through our sponsor break. So let's get on with tonight's show. Okay, we ended up with landing in Hot Springs after you have gotten Justin's 10-minute, 30-second history of Hot Springs National Park. It has significance historically because, like any other spring in the entire United States, and probably the world over, but we definitely have this culture in the U.S. in the 18th and 19th centuries, specifically the 19th into the 20th centuries, 18th century, not so much. That is a misquote on my part, a mis speak, as it were. But there was a whole culture with this, right? And a lot of it came back to snake oil, which we'll talk about later, curative healing powers. And this place was no different. Hot Springs was no different. And so a lot of people were coming here. And for a lot of people, it probably did bring relief. And many of you have experienced, like, taking an Epsom salt bath, right? It'll really, like, make you feel better. It'll help the old joints. It absolutely does. A good hot bath and any kind of minerals, but especially certain ones, like, again, say Epsom salts, it makes a difference. Some people do it in magnesium, which isn't that, that might actually be Epsom salt. I don't know. Point is, a good long hot soak in a bath is good for the bones and will make you feel a lot better. And so it probably was believed to have some curative powers back in its day, but that was absolutely appropriated by unscrupulous businessmen, which the world is known for, especially the capitalistic world. And it becomes a thing, and suddenly resorts spring up, and suddenly the bougiest of the bouge, the bourgeois, they show up, and people who would like to be like the bourgeoisie show up. Proletariat or not, everybody wants to have a little me day, even in 1899 and 1905, 1922. It just rolls downhill from there to where we are today. But anyway, moving back to the point of tonight's show, this is a very significant cultural space. I mean, it has human occupational history going back, what is it, 12,000 years? I believe, man, we're talking way early. 12,000 to 10,000 before present. So yes, 12,000 years ago, we've had indigenous peoples visiting this site intermittently for, you know, 12,000 years. We get into the French coming up into America. They started to frequent the site, and then we roll into our time frame. But these springs have been a cultural gathering place for over 12,000 years, probably about as long as people have been in this section of North America. That alone is significant. But also, you have this history where this entire resort industry develops, and you have this entire small town spring up around these springs. And we have, well, really, much of that history still with us today for us to go and explore it. And it's really neat, you know, as you travel through these hills and mountains and you go to visit Hot Springs, if you know some of the history, you're thinking about these things like, holy cow, the American bison used to roam here. All these early expeditions, they were hunting bison to supplement their food supply. Think about the early settlers coming by wagon train, coming up the river, the Hunter Dunbar expedition. I forgot to mention this. These guys like designed their own boat, and it wasn't a keel boat, which probably would have served their purposes much better for the shallow Washita River with all of its chutes and narrows and rapids and little waterfalls. They designed their own boat, which was 50 feet long. It had like a 35-foot mast or something. This thing was like a mini sailboat. This thing had to weigh literal tons. And they were dragging it and pulling it up this shallow river, the Washita River. Many of you don't know what the Washita is like. Any of you here in state who've ever floated on the Washita as I have. What? There are places in the journals where they talk about the soldiers who were sent to accompany them, having to use ropes and make like levers out of oars and big poles to actually push this 50 foot long, like sailing scow barge thing up over 3 foot drop waterfalls through rapids against the current. What? You think it sucks being stuck in rush hour traffic while you're listening to your podcast with the AC on? Imagine that. And yes, it does suck being stuck in traffic, no matter what you're doing. But that is mind-blowing to me. You want to talk about give you some perspective. They were dragging a freaking 50-foot-long boat over rapids against the water. I don't want to ever hear any of you people complaining about, well, the water was low on the Buffalo today. I had to get out and drag my canoe a couple of times. Like, man, no. Anyway, there's a lot of cultural history here. And as these bathhouses sprang up, this was like in conjunction, obviously, with the federal government to some degree, because this was considered to be public property. The history gets a little bit complicated and fascinating, but what do you need to know? What is Hot Springs National Park? When you drive down onto the row, you're looking at Hot Springs National Park. Okay, this is where it becomes the idiot's guide to Hot Springs National Park. We had no idea what we were driving into. What is it? What does it do? What will I see? When you drive down the street in front of Bathhouse Row, you just saw it. That is Hot Springs National Park. It might be a little bit of a misnomer, to be completely honest. When we think of a national park, is not the first thought that comes to mind. Yosemite, the Grand Canyon, Yellowstone, Great Smoky Mountains, depending on your region, right? What comes to mind? Gigantic vistas, beautiful views, natural wonders. Hot Springs would probably be better designated as a National Historic Site, because what Hot Springs is the side of that hill where all the springs are now collected in spring boxes and issue out of those bathhouses that are all historic in nature. The visitor center, for example, the Fordyce, I believe it is the Fordyce, is, yes, the National Park Visitor Center and Museum. The museum's cool as heck. You wander through that guy and check out everything that's in there and see how these bathhouses functioned. And some of them you can still go into and use as a bathhouse today. Highly recommend that. But that's what you're looking at. This is Hot Springs National Park in a nutshell. It's Bathhouse Row. And it's really probably better designated as a National Historic Site. First pro tip. I was kind of surprised. Okay. You can walk down the Grand Promenade, which was built very early on. The date's in front of me somewhere. I'm not going to dig in and find it. It is really neat. It's a cool place, and it is a natural wonder, but like, you don't really see the springs issuing from the side of the hill as they once did. They are collected in these collectors. You can see all the history that is in all of these buildings, no matter which one you visit, the bookstore, the visitor center, or any of the ones that are still privately operated where you can go take a hot bath. But this is Hot Springs National Park. That's it. Now, it encompasses a much larger area. There are over 26 miles of trails that you can walk throughout the park. Some of them are most of them are very, very short, half mile, 0.1 miles, 0.3 miles, but there's 26 miles in total. There's a couple of trails that go around the perimeter of the park, up in the mountains, around the park, Hot Springs Mountain, West Mountain. Those are closer to a moderate rating. So there's 26 miles of trails. There's a lot of wilderness you can see. There's a ton of wildlife down there. It's absolutely beautiful, but like Hot Springs National Park, what is really there for you to see is Bathhouse Row. And it's totally worth doing. But, you know, just traveler beware, you know, just kind of know, because it surprised me. I thought there was like something else more than that. It's an awesome place. Awesome place. I'm not bagging on it, but it's just like one of those things. Understand what it is. Now, there's a lot to do in downtown. Bathhouse Row is the national park. The whole area is really in the national park. But that's like what is actually really truthfully preserved within Hot Springs National Park. Now, what else is down there on the row? One thing that if you do a quick Google of Hot Springs that you cannot miss, that is the Arlington Hotel. Originally built in 1875, the current structure was built in 1924, and it is famously, famously haunted. And it is a cool structure, y'all. Very, very cool, very historic down at the end of the street. Al Capone stayed there. That's not like folklore, legend, myth. That is factual. The suite that he loved the most is the Al Capone suite, the Capone suite. And you can stay there to this day. Babe Ruth stayed there. A literal ton of presidents stayed there. Bush was one of them. Clinton was one of them. Going way back. Some of the Roosevelts, I believe, stayed there. Very, very famous hotel. It was very, very, very fancy. It was super extra for its day, especially, and actually ties to other Arkansas properties. It's, you know, very reminiscent to me of the Crescent or the Basin Park Hotel in Eureka Springs. We did a whole episode on the Crescent about a year ago, this time, actually almost exactly a year ago. What you need to know about it today is what was bougie in 1924, not so bougie today. We actually talked to a couple who were setting out on the deck. They were super sweet. And I was just curious because we did not stay at the Arlington. It is pricey. And I was like, hey, what'd you guys think about your stay. You know, was it really cool? Is it worth it? And their takeaway was, well, the man was like, well, the history here is very, very cool. And the wife's take on it was, it wasn't what I expected. And what we gathered through that conversation is, I feel like it was probably a lot like the Basin Park in Eureka Springs, which is these old buildings show their age. You stay for a historical experience, and they're nice. You know, they're nice. They're clean. They're really nice places to stay. But in your mind, when you're being sold, say, a luxury stay, you're probably thinking of something more modern luxury. These are luxury of their day, and they show their age a little bit. They take a lot of work to keep going, and they're totally worth staying at. Again, not me bagging on it at all. As a historian, I love that stay. Y'all, I'm not concerned with, oh, the crown molding has a little bit of a nick on it and the paint hasn't been refreshed in 3 years. You know, like, there's levels. Everyone has their levels, right? Everyone has their levels. But understand that what you're staying for is to stay in history and to sleep with a ghost, which sounds pretty cool if you ask me. But that's just me, right? You may not dig that kind of thing. However, that was kind of their take on it. And after I did some review reading, I found that that's what a lot of people's take on it was. You know, we actually heard a lady freaking out at the Basin Park when we were in Eureka, for example. Like, she was very upset. She felt like she had been sold something she didn't get. You know, I didn't feel that way. I love staying at the Basin. That was the coolest place ever. Crescent is gorgeous. But again, I love history. I love history. And I am not, well, a yuppie. So that makes a difference. What are your levels? Understand that. But the Arlington is super historic. It is a beautiful structure. It is extremely haunted, and extremely famous people have stayed there over the last century. Actually, it'd be 100 this year, wouldn't it? Yep, current structure, 1924. So the Arlington is a prominent fixture in Hot Springs National Park in downtown Hot Springs, right outside of the row. There are a lot of really cool historical structures all throughout that same general area. Oh, and I should mention parking, because parking's an issue. We drove twice up and down the street trying to figure out exactly. No. We finally found a place at the far end. It was a lot of walking, but we actually did find a place on the street with like a parking meter. And it was on Derby Day, as a matter of fact. Many of you have heard of, say, the Kentucky Derby. You know what horse racing is. Well, we have Oaklawn here in Arkansas, and we just happened to be there. No idea, because I don't give a crap about horse racing, that it was Derby Day. And the way we found out was actually quite fascinating. There were people walking around everywhere dressed like Harry and Lloyd in Dumb and Dumber when they were going to the ball to hunt down Mary Swanson, right? In their orange and blue suits. There were people everywhere dressed thus. But all of the ladies had incredible hats on, because apparently that is a Derby tradition dating back all the way to, well, England. As a matter of fact, I actually had to look that up. Hats are a thing with horse races. And there were some crazy hats out on the street that day, which was super cool. Matter of fact, there's some hat shops, because Oaklawn's a big deal down there around Little Rock, Hot Springs. Oaklawn's a big deal. They had some hat shops. So we went in and like window shopped around in this hat shop, and that was fun. On Derby Day, I nearly bought a Derby. I am not sure that I am ready just yet to fully commit to the historian midlife crisis mode and wear a Derby around, but I'll say it looked pretty darn good on me. I have a picture of it, and I will probably end up buying a Derby at some point. I almost bought a Derby on Derby Day right there in downtown Hot Springs. But it was like $50. And I was like, yeah, probably not going to wear it, so I'm not paying that. I wonder if Temu has derbies. I bet they do. Anyway, there's a lot to explore in downtown, but you need to find a place to park. I mean, honestly, what I would say is when you roll in, depending on which direction you come from, take a run down the strip and look for anywhere you might could whip in right there on the side of the street. Like, we got lucky first run, and it was Derby Day. It was a busy day on a Saturday. It was popping. And we managed to have a spot right on the street, even though it was like a mile walk back to Bathhouse Row, probably a half mile to be fair. But I suggest this, because we actually, after a little bit, again, Idiot's Guide to Hot Springs, after we checked out Bathhouse Row, we talked to the rangers. You know, that's the first thing I suggest once you find parking. is go straight to the four dice and get oriented. Let the rangers orient you. Where am I at? What is there to see? Like, get that overview and then check out the museum there. But after we had done that, after we had went to the bookstore and got our passport stamps, and I stood around and talked for 30 minutes to the staff in Eastern National there, because that's what Justin does, much to Jess's chagrin. We walked a little bit more. We explored some of the shop fronts, and we were like, oh, we went down the promenade. We went up and took pictures of the Army-Navy Hospital, which is right around the corner. We bought a jar to put hot springs water straight out of the spring into, which I did. And I actually took out and, you know, had with me during the solar eclipse, just because that's some witchy woo-woo stuff. And I like playing around these days. Why not? Let's see. I mean, I ain't going to drink it or nothing. I just thought it was fun. I infused a little cultural experience into that hot springs, hot water on solar eclipse day, just because I could, not because I intend to do anything with it. I didn't know nothing about voodoo. I just thought it'd be cool. I got some hot springs water charged by the solar eclipse. I'm weird like that. Give me experiences. Give me culture. I think it's awesome. Anyway, there's a lot to do along the strip there, but we were like, this is it. Okay. What do we do now? It's noon, 1 o'clock, right? So we actually took a little adventure, and this is good for you to know. We decided, well, there's a couple of state park stamps that we still need. Well, there's several, but there are two state parks within 30 minutes drive of Hot Springs National Park, and that is Lake Catherine and Lake Washita. So we went down to those two parks, and we got our stamps, and we kind of explored them a little bit, and then came back later in the evening to Hot Springs, and I don't remember why. Maybe we wanted to see it at night. Oh, we wanted to eat dinner somewhere downtown. So we came back later in the evening, right? Closer to evening time, and discovered the smart thing to do isn't like park in their public parking garage that's like right across from Bathhouse Row, basically. Parking, if you're getting there early, I do suggest going early to get parking, because we drove all the way up all four of the decks before we finally spotted someone backing out, and little Clemmy, being the little feisty little, you know, tiny car that she is, I was able to get whipped around and whipped into that spot before anyone else did, which I wasn't cheating. I was ahead of everyone. People coming up behind me were going to steal it, and that wasn't happening. Clemmy's got wheels, and we used those wheels. But that's the way to go. In my opinion, park there in that public parking. It's a parking deck situation. You can find it on Google Maps. It's right across from Bathhouse Row, right across the street. That's the way to go, if you ask me. But when we went back in the evening for dinner, we decided to kind of explore up and down the street. That is when I nearly bought my derby hat, for example. But we had dinner at a place called Grateful Head Pizza and Beer Garden, which is right next to that parking deck that's set back off of the row. Yeah, it's not period, that's for sure, but it's back off of the main street, and it doesn't really take away from the aesthetic or the ambiance of Bathhouse Row where it sets. And actually, it's probably pretty much necessary, because Hot Springs is a happening place, and there ain't nowhere to park, like, except on the side of the street. It's a tough situation, so they kind of need it. That's what I suggest. Park there. And then we wandered up and down the street. We checked out the hat shop. We at some point took pictures for people who were going to the Derby, because they were all dressed to the nines, and that was super fun. But we had dinner at a place called Grateful Head Pizza and Beer Garden. And though I did not partake of the beer garden, we took where we were able to sit as quickly as possible. A lot of people, very cool place, very into the Grateful Dead, if you didn't figure that out from the name. I just dawned on me, what's clever about that? I was like, Grateful Head, what does that mean? I know what the Grateful Dead are, but what's the cleverness of Grateful Head? Oh, it's a pizzeria and a beer garden. The Grateful Head, head on a beer. I get it now. Hi, that only took me a month to figure out. I feel brilliant tonight. I just have to keep telling myself I'm still got a 4.0. I'm book smart, not street smart. Let's go with that. But it was really good. I love pizza. Pizza anywhere is a good indicator of how good the local fare is. You know, you cannot go wrong with pizza, as it were. As the kids say, it's a total move. No matter what, pizza is always a move. And this pizza, staying in theme, was fire. No cap. Ah, God, that's terrible. Anyway, we're gonna leave it in. We're gonna leave it in. Anyway, it was really good pizza. And you should check it out. Absolutely. Really neat place. And you just wander up and down the street as it got dark. And it is quite beautiful. Like National Park, the downtown scene, very, very neat place. There was a place called Kilwin's Sweets, and they had some pretty amazing ice cream. We did partake of ice cream after we had some Grateful Head pizza. And, you know, you start to figure out your midlife when your tummy hurts after you have pizza and ice cream at 5 o'clock at night. That's kind of a sad realization, but such as it is. Now, there are a few other things to check out around Hot Springs. One of the first things I always do is like, I just like Google Urbex and the area I'm going to, and then Rurex in the area I'm going to, because who does not like abandoned stuff, right? Well, it turns out that real close to downtown Hot Springs is an abandoned bottle watering factory that is collapsing into the ground and makes for some cool Urbex, which is more like Rurex at this point, but you can't find it. There are no directions to it. It's kind of a secret that people are doing a pretty good job of keeping, and I'm going to continue with that because if I tell you all, then you'll come and you'll take all of it. It's a little bit of a screener, and I leave it to you with this, that the reason I do it this way is if I manage to figure out how to get there, and it took work. I used Google Satellite View. I was using clues out of forums. I was reading articles and trying to, like, it took some clue searching for me to find this place and exactly where it was. But the point is, if I can find it, so can you. And that works as a screener. If you're willing to put in the work to find it, you're more than likely willing to treat it with respect and just go take your pictures, right? Make your video and not destroy it or artifact rob it, right? It is there. It's right off the side of a road. Once you see it, you can't miss it. And there are no fences. It is not no trespassing as of this date in 2024, which we are at the end of April right now as this episode drops. They did tell us at the National Park, though, that it has come into the possession, finally, of some historic preservation society. So that may change, and that will be good. But if you want to find it, you can find it. And there's some really neat pictures for any of you who are respectful enough to go and explore it. Well, again, in a respectful manner. But I'm going to tell you about it here because it was a really fun little adventure. And I'm going to give you a little bit of the history on it because, I mean, anytime you find a building falling into the ground, into the woods, you kind of want to know what was going on there. And this place, known as the Chuwakla Mineral Springs Company, has quite a colorful history, as it were. This is early, early days in the commercializing of one of these water sources in a very, very charlatan-esque snake oil type of manner. This all comes, by the way, from the Encyclopedia of Arkansas. Chuwakla Mineral Springs Company. The cold water springs below the site of the bottling factory of Chuwakla Mineral Springs Company, later the Sleepy Hollow Water Company, outside of Hot Springs, became a national sensation with backers from Chicago and an expert, quote, end quote, touting their radioactive medicinal value. Cultural note, back in the 19-teens and 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s, radium was all the rage, y'all. Like now, you know, we figured out, shoot, we blow up cities with it. It's a pretty bad deal. But back then, people thought radium was great. It was in toothpaste. It was in all kinds of things. Anyway, there were songs about it. Any of you play Fallout? Listen to some of the songs in the background of Fallout. It'll give you some context. This was a real thing that happened. Anyway, Guy Lombardo and his Royal Canadians wrote a song dedicated to the sleepy waters of Hot Springs, Arkansas. Radio programs and newspapers such as the Chicago Tribune disseminated testimonials of what the water could cure. The bottling factory was located on what is now Sleepy Valley Road off of Highway 7 South, just north of Hot Springs proper and within Hot Springs National Park. In the 21st century, the remains of the facility are not marked by any path. In a 1986 publication, Bill Dever recorded a legend about the springs from a brochure for the company that said, "One such spring, as legend has it, was named after an Indian princess whose father, the chief, came to the area to utilize the waters for recuperation." The name Chuwakla was, in this legend, said to mean sleepy water and was given to the springs since the water gave the restful and relaxed feeling that a deep sleep gives a person. Although the company used this legend and the logo for their marketing pamphlets, which is a Native American's head and profile, it's very, very, very appropriate for the time, as it were. And appropriate is a dual meaning word here. Even though it was used in this manner, the Quapaw, Choctaw, and Osage, any of the peoples who would have ever been in this area whatsoever, do not recognize the legend nor the word Chewakla from their language, and they assert that the Native Americans never did more than trade in the area that became Hot Springs, which, by the way, archaeology tends to back. And this gives you an example of early cultural appropriation. And when you hear that term in the modern zeitgeist, in the modern PC culture, and it can be a very hot button topic, this gives you some idea of what true cultural appropriation really is. They told lies that were very stereotypical and stereotyped a group of people in order to monetize for gain for themselves, and not even those people that they were appropriating, those people's culture in a very, very, very stereotypical way that was not true. I even used Google Translate to try to see if Chewakla was a word in any language, and it is not. Just by the way, totally made up out of whole cloth to make money, and that is cultural appropriation by its definition. And that is today's Cultural Anthropology Corner with Justin. So, this information on the early history of the company tells us that in 1913, in a Mineral Resources of the United States report, that it was functioning at that early of a date. But it was also functioning as late as 1859. So sometime in the last 60 to 70 years, it was abandoned. There's actually very little history on when it was abandoned. But what you need to know is that this place is super cool to urbex today. If you go over, no, it's not up yet. Crap, that's what I'm going to have to do tomorrow night, is edit those pictures. I haven't done them yet. Yo, anyway, I will get those done. Actually, over the next day or two, and get them onto my Instagram, waywardson119. When you listen to this episode, if you go check it out and they're not there, check back in a day or two, because I will get those done with this episode drop sometime this week. Super cool pictures, y'all. There's little gazebos around, like the building. There's a few walls standing. The native face in profile is up still on the facade of the building. Super, super cool, but it's being overtaken by the woods big time, and the creek that runs right next to it, which is some of the springs that they were bottling, are actually eroding away a cut bank that's going right through like basically a historical trash midden that came from that factory without a doubt. And right there in the cut bank, there are just like dozens of big green shards of glass that are eroding out of the bank into the stream bed, which is literally probably crap that was like failing on the line, the glass shattered, whatever, they threw it out into the midden. And it's so old that there's actually probably 30 and 40 year old trees growing on top of this midden that is now washing out into the creek. And there's all these like big, thick, green chunks of glass coming out of the creek bank. And that is like history happening. And that was cool as heck to experience and see. Man, I'd wished that there had been like one full bottle somewhere in that. There was not. And I left all the glass I found, you know, leave no trace, as it were. But it's a really, really neat place to explore. And if you do your research, you can go and explore it as well. But I'm going to make you do your research, because I'm not just going to hand you the keys, kid. Like, you just now getting your driver's license. I'm not handing you the keys without some training on how to respect the road. You know what I'm saying? Anyway, we're getting close to the end of the episode, so let's kind of wrap this out with, you know, a quick overview. Hot Springs National Park, The Idiot's Guide. What you got mostly tonight was the history of the area, because really what Hot Springs National Park is Bathhouse Row. It's a lot of history. Really cool stuff. The bathhouses are incredibly photogenic if you like photography. The springs themselves you can drink. I suggest that you try a taste of one. It's interesting. Get you some spring in a water. Bring it home with you. Put it on the shelf. Super neat place. You can get your national park passport. And also Hot Springs is hosting the Iron Ranger Challenge. At least they did last year. And I believe they are this year, because they're the ones that told us about it. Even though their current, the website is not current to 2024, but the Iron Ranger in Arkansas is, if you do 100 miles of trails in a self-propelled fashion in Arkansas and any state lands from Corps of Engineers, which would be like trails along the tops of river dikes, all the way, or levees, all the way to state parks, national parks, anywhere else within the state of Arkansas, if you do 100 miles recorded, it's kind of on the honor system, then you can get your Iron Ranger badge, which is a cool, like, patch. I think it's an iron-on patch, and you get a certificate, and it's an Iron Ranger thing. There's a lot of neat programs, guys, that are out there to, like, encourage you to go, and you get neat little keepsakes to put in your collection of stuff. And Hot Springs is hosting that Iron Ranger. You can get your Junior Ranger badge. You can get a couple of state park passport stamps within 30 minutes of Hot Springs National Park. There's pizza, there's ice cream, there's old school bass, there's a haunted hotel, like, and there's an abandoned bottling company, right, to get your Urbex photography. What more could you ask for? Hot Springs is a cool place to go. Anyway, that is going to wrap up our Idiot's Guide to Hot Springs National Park. I actually talked a lot, and I don't know if I really said anything, but I do think that you probably get the gist of it. Find the parking garage, hit Bathhouse Row, have some pizza, have some ice cream, and just explore one of America's first national parks and get that stamp in your passport. Anyway, we're going to wrap it up for tonight, guys. Thanks for sticking around all the way to the end. Thanks for hanging with us through 90 episodes, which is 200 podcast years old. That is insane to me, but here we are. And I thank you guys for supporting us all the way. The end of the road housekeeping is, if you want to get in touch, mywaywardstory@gmail.com, or go check out our website over at www.waywardstories.com. I look forward to talking to you guys again in a couple of weeks, where hopefully I will have something for us to talk about. We will be in week 2 of my new class when that rolls around, so we'll see how much brain space Justin actually has available. Until next time, guys, you go out and find yourself some new adventures to chase, some new wonders to see, and get out there and, like, find yourself or something. But while you're doing it, don't forget to be good to each other.